All right. It's going to be a great weekend in about an hour from now. I am extremely thrilled to be here tonight and be asked back. I'm humbled to be asked back to Cartersville, Georgia. I was here before, and I've seen a lot of people that I know, and Jerry and Jeanette, and thank you for asking me. And it's an honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Joe Krogan. I'm an alcoholic. And don't you love AA? And I'm so, and the reason I'm so happy to be here with you is because a lot of you seem to know each other, and there seems to be this great spirit of recovery here. And to be invited in and to share and to have you share your recovery with me, thank you. I'm going to take some of it back home with me. I know that. So thank you. You're going to make my family and my AA family a lot happier, at least for a day or two. That's why they ask, why do you keep going to those meetings? I tell them, I got to help those people. No, I feel pretty good. I had a drink at the bar before I came here, and so I told Randy, take the edge off. Just a glass of wine. I remember one day I was on vacation with my wife, and we're sitting at a sidewalk cafe overlooking the Mediterranean. It was beautiful sunset, and we were in this beautiful restaurant. And I look over, and next to us is a couple, and they got a bottle of wine in the bucket, and it's chilling. And I said, you know, I think I was 17 or 18 years sober at the time, and I said, why can't I have a glass of wine? She goes, you never drank wine when you drank. I didn't. We pull out these snapshots of what we think is fun and a good time, or an old girlfriend, right, if you're new. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody knows where Palm Coast is. I mean, even Mike. And I know it's a tricky word. But, you know, everybody. So people come up and they talk to me. They go, where are you from? Palm Coast. But, well, where's that at? Well, it's near Daytona, and only in AA. It's not like, you know, in normal functions when people, social gatherings, people get together and say, where are you from? Or I'm from Palm Coast. Oh, it's wonderful. There was a nice restaurant there. Oh, I stayed at a nice hotel there. Or isn't that, don't they have a beautiful beach? In AA, you go, oh, I got arrested there. No kidding. Me too. What was it for? That was my sixth DUI, you know. And so it's only in Alcoholics Anonymous. And before I begin, let me just get a feel, because everybody looks so clean and sober, and I think there's a lot of sobriety in this room. Is there any, and not to embarrass you, but is there anyone here under a year sober? Please raise your hand. Okay, great. Great. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to talk real fast because I know you're going to be real busy looking for her or him and judging the rest of us, okay? So I'm going to talk fast. So now I know you're all from Georgia, so we might need a translator. Where's Mike? You know? See, if you can laugh at yourself... Thank God, because otherwise I won't be here tomorrow, I'll tell you that. You know, because we tend to take ourselves so serious. And it's like new people in AA. Don't you love new people? Because everything you ask them is like a trick question. Right? It's like you ask them a yes-no answer, and it's like a trick question. A couple real hard ones for them are, where are you living? Whoa. You know, they don't want, well, I'm staying over here, but that's not really where I'm from, or I'm with mom, you know, or here's another good one. Are you married? Well, not to her, but, or a real trick question for a new guy is, where are you working? Work. You might get an answer what they do, but you won't get an answer what they're working, where they're working, right? So, see, we know this because we've done it, right? They're laughing because they know, you know. And but I love Alcoholics Anonymous because it was the only place I found a place to be comfortable in it. And thank you. The kindness of strangers. Most of us are here because of the kindness of strangers. And What a society we have. My sobriety date is September 12, 1990. I think if I stay sober another 3-4 weeks, I'll have 27 years. And thank you. And I know I don't look that old. No. my wife thanks you for allowing me to be here. We were here when Elvis was here, when the good Elvis was here. Not the second year, the one that needed the white chip. The first year, right? We were here when the good Elvis, he was still in good shape. You know, drinking's a two-sided coin. And that was a prime example. There's the good times, and then that coin flips over one day. And it's just, man, you're treading water, and you know you're going down sooner or later. But I didn't ask I told my wife she can't come back because she got a little hot and bothered for Elvis. She liked him a little too much. So did a lot of the other women that were here. No, she wishes she could be here. She's with our granddaughter at home. So, my home group is Life's a Beach. It meets in Palm Coast every Sunday night, and hopefully I'll be there Sunday night. I was taught about commitments, and I believe that commitments are what helped me stay sober. It's not knowledge, it's not willpower, it's a commitment. It's a commitment to show up when I don't want to show up. Because if you're an alcoholic of my type, we only did what we wanted to do. Had to be at gunpoint, right? Had to be at gunpoint to make me do anything. And I'm one of those alcoholics. You know, the book talks about the different types of alcoholic there are. It says there are those that are normal in every respect except for their drinking. That's not me. I'm the grave mental and emotional disorder guy, okay? And now the trouble with insanity, now don't laugh because you're insane too. You can't get here without being insane. I mean, you know, we tend to get a little self-righteous after we've been here for a while. We think we know something and we want to tell people and demonstrate. But the truth is, my wife puts me in my place so often, and she'll say things like, "Aren't you lucky you didn't get what you deserved? Aren't we all lucky we didn't get what we deserved? We ought to walk in with our resumes in our hand, right? What did you get here for? Well, here's my list of offenses, you know." Oh, man, that's great. Would you speak at our meeting next week? Holy cow. Right? We forget, and they're not that far away, man. They're not that far away. I didn't grow up to be an alcoholic. Let me tell you a little bit about my drinking. I like drinking. And I drank. I always overshot the mark. Did anybody overshoot the mark? What the heck is with that? You know, tonight I'm really going to get to that place. You know that place. Man, that was so nice. That was it. That was the place I was looking for. But I always overshot the mark, and then I started to develop systems to not overshoot the mark. The first was preemptive puking. I knew I was going to puke. So let's drink real fast, go throw up, and you come back out with a little puke on you, but you're ready for the girls at the bar, right? What a catch I was. And then, of course, I discovered some other substances that would help you drink longer and not throw up. Now, listen, don't get offended. I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in our singleness of purpose. But I did do drugs. I found alcohol. In my experience, in the 26 years that I've been here, I found alcoholics like drugs. And if you're not aware of that, be careful what's in your medicine cabinet because it's killing us today. But if you're an old timer and you've never done any drugs, too bad, it's too late. Okay? I told somebody today, man, if I go back out, I'm doing meth. You know, so, no lurking, no reservation, no lurking notion. But anyway, so let me tell you a little bit of how I drank. I'm not, you know, Drunkalog, I love Drunkalogs, and we've all got them, and they're wonderful. But I'm going to just give you my qualifications for drinking. I didn't stop, I ran out. And I didn't quit, I got caught. I get stopped. I don't quit. That's how I drank. From the very start, it was the adventure. I was, you know, and I didn't think it was the alcohol or the drug. I didn't think the alcohol was the substance. I swear I used to. I thought it released the real me. Didn't you? I thought it released the real me. Ah, so that's who I always was. I've spent these last 18 years being this insecure, frightened, self-conscious kid, you know? And then it released me, and I went from having a bit part in the movie to being the star. And, you know, the star of the movie can say no wrong, can do no wrong, no matter what he does, right? I became the most honorable, stand-up guy, you know, confident. Matter of fact, we read it here. At this meeting, it says, we're going to have a new freedom and a new happiness. It says, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will know how our experience can benefit others. That was me. I was in the bar room telling you what you should be. I know everything. And I'm going to tell you what to do. Dump that girl. You know, quit that job. Go punch that guy in the nose. He doesn't appreciate you. Right? I knew everything about everything. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Right? Spend my last $50. That just came to me intuitively. You know. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave you. Didn't it? Man, it scares me to think of some of the places I drank and did other things. And people used to see me, and some of the people I was with, I mean, I think they're in the back row here. So those promises came true when I drank. Alcohol, there was the good years. I mean, let's face it, there was the good years. It's a two-sided coin. If there wasn't the good years, see, it did something for me that I just didn't know what it was doing. And we can't put our name on it. We can't put a word on it almost. It's a feeling. What? And I used to be so delusional. I used to go out and have fun and socialize and dance. You see me dancing today, I need to pick up a white chip. But I would do and have fun and do all these things. And I used to say things like this. Listen, especially when it started getting a little heavy. Alcohol is just the accessory. It's not the main event. It's the main event. And it becomes the main event, and you don't know it's the main event. I never drank at work, because this is the type of alcoholic I am. If I drank at work, I'm not working. I don't work. I either drink or I work. I'm not doing both. I'm not a multitasker. I don't multitask my drinking, right? I don't drink at lunch because I'm not going back to work. I don't drink with dinner because if I'm drinking tonight, I'm fasting. Right? Who wants to drink? I need to be light. You never know what's going to happen today. There's going to be an adventure somewhere. It was an adventure. It was like getting, man, where is this going to... And in the beginning, I used to tell the truth about it. Let's go get loaded, man. Right? We used to tell the truth. Let's go get loaded. That was... We were on a mission from God. We were like the Blues Brothers. And it was fun. Only at the end did I lie. Tonight, I'm only going to have a couple. And Randy said it when I was kidding with him, and I said I had a drink at the bar. He goes, if you only had one drink, you don't need to be our speaker. And he's right. He's right. That's kind of how I drank. And I did it looking for... And I didn't like the taste. I was a guzzler. Let's get it down quick. Now, at the end, I thought I liked the taste. What I liked is the effect. We drink primarily because of the effect. And everything that happened, all that things... And now, my sobriety date is September 12th, 1990. It was 5 days before my 40th birthday. I had never been to an AA meeting, I'd never been to a detox, and I'd never been to a treatment center. But let me tell you what it looked like. We're going to flash back to September 11th. September 12th, I don't remember a heck of a lot about September 12th. I remember a heck of a lot about September 11th. That was a bad day for me. And on September 11th, 1990, let me tell you where I was. I was in a Skid Row motel room in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I had my 2-year-old son and his mom, and I had been in that motel room for 6 months. They couldn't get me out. I was like a squatter. I move in, I don't move out. You get the jaws of life can't get me out of there. And that little boy was in filthy diapers, and he had a bottle that at once held milk, but it was just cloudy water. And if Child Welfare Services had walked into that room today, I'd be in jail. I don't know about then. I wasn't that aware. But I'll tell you what, I love that little boy. I loved that little boy. When that little boy was born, I was in the hospital when that little boy was born, and I held him in my arms, and I cried like a baby. And it was something happened in my life. I fell in love with another human being for the first time in my life. It was like a light switch got thrown in my life. I knew there was another person in this world for the first time in my life. There was another person in this world, and I was 38 years old, and it was the first time in my life I'd ever loved another human being. And I made that little boy promises. I held him in my arms. I said, I'm going to be the best dad in the world. I'm going to coach you in Little League and baseball and basketball and football. We're going to go hang out together. We're going to be able to hug each other and tell each other we love each other. You're going to know you're loved. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And I put that little boy back down into the nursery. And I turned around, and in the waiting room were some friends, couple of friends I had left in the world. And they said, let's go have a drink to celebrate the birth of your son. 8 days later, I went home. I don't even know how he got home from the hospital, how they got home from the hospital. That's what I do when I love somebody. That's how powerful alcohol is in my life, and drugs. I will step over anything in my life to get to my next drink or drug. I heard a guy say one time, he says, I will not give up my son for the first drink. I'll give him up for the second one. Right? Once that phenomenon of craving they talk about. Now, I hated that word. If you're new, this phenomenon of craving, it sounds so dramatic. You know, right? I mean, I used to picture a guy sitting there shaking going, I need a drink. Now it is that, but that's not what it looked like in my life. What it looked like in my life is this. I think I'll have another. Let's have another. You know, where are you going? It's early. It's only midnight. Well, I've got to work tomorrow. That's not a good reason to stop. My wife will be mad. That's a less better reason to stop. I mean, we spent a lot of money and time and energy to get to this point. We're just getting going. I don't stop, I run out. And that's the way I liked it. That's the way I drank. The promises came true in my life. Why would I want anything else in my life? Why would I want to go back to being that blob before? That no personality, no fun guy. And we're in this hotel room, this motel room, and we had been there for 6 months practically. I was unemployed and unemployable. It was filthy. It was squalor. There was no food. It was filthy diapers. There was no food in this place. There was no milk. And I'm going to tell you what. You know, if the phenomenon of craving was my only problem, because it talks, even Bill talks about it. He says, you know, in Bill's story, there's a line in his story. He says to us, he goes, I knew this had to be stopped. I can't do this anymore. I knew this had to be stopped. There had been many sweet promises, but this time I meant business. And my wife knew it, and so did I. That's his exact words. You know what the next sentence is? Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. How does that happen? Now, I don't know about you, but it talks about it in the doctor's opinion. It says, after they succumb to the drink, as so many do, they enter the well-known stages of a spree. I'm a spree drinker. Okay? Now, I know my wife is not. She's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was a daily closet drinker. I'm a spree drinker, but my, you know, the period between sprees was like about 6-7 minutes. It's like coming up for air when you're swimming underwater. Back under. It says, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do this again. But this is repeated over and over again. How do I do it? On page 22 in our big book, and here, I love this part in the book. And if you're new, this is it, man. The phenomenon of craving is the problem I've been trying to fix for 20 years of my drinking. Well, at least for the last 10. The first 10 were a lot of fun. You didn't care. It was reckless abandon. It's riding the roller coaster. And then the last 10, what you want to do is try and take a half of a roller coaster ride. There's no such thing. You're on for the, you take that drink, you're on for the full ride. And you never know when it's going to stop or where it's going to stop. And I would try to fix, what I was trying to fix was the phenomenon of craving, and I didn't know that. I would wake up, maybe some of you have done this. Let me describe what it was like for that first, and this was towards the end of my drinking, in that motel room. After a spree, you crack your eyelids open. Anybody remember that feeling? Cracking your eyelids open after a binge? And the first thought that was in my mind when I'd crack my eyelids open is, damn, I'm not dead. Now, I wasn't suicidal. I didn't want to kill myself. I just did not want to wake up. I did not want to be in my life again. And I know there's people that know what I'm talking about because there's heads nodding here. I was trapped in a life I couldn't get out of. And then the guilt, the shame, the remorse would be on me like a weight. The hideous four horsemen would be on you, and you would. I would look at my little boy in his crib in filthy diapers, and I would cry real tears. And then I would do what I call the alcoholic dance, which is this. That's it. I'm done. I swear to God. I'm going to be a dad today. I'm going to go get a job. I'm going to put some food in here. I'm done with this. I'm going to turn my life around. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to pay the bills. And I mean it from the bottom. And I meant it with everything inside of me. Anybody ever meant it? I mean, really meant it as hard as you could? And here's how I started drinking again. I simply forgot I quit. Most of the time, I simply forgot I quit. Sobriety would become so unbearable that it's like an itch that just needs to be scratched. And next thing you know, I'm scratching it, and I'm going, damn, I'm drinking again, or I'm smoking, or I'm snorting, or I'm doing something to make me feel better than what I did. See, I have a chronic case, a terminal sense of lack. There is never enough of what we think we need, as Bill says. Never. And it says that we want more pleasure and satisfaction than, listen to this, that is due us or possible. So we're screwed, okay? First of all, we don't deserve it, and we want more than is even possible. So it's insatiable. We'll never satisfy it. So what happened in that motel room, binge after binge, I would wake up, damn, I'm not dead. Now why? September 11th, let me tell you what happened on September 11th. I call it my reverse spiritual awakening. Now, I had had moments of clarity. We all have them. Coming home after a three-dayer and your wife or your girlfriend's there or your husband finds, you know, a guy's phone number in your purse or something after you've been drinking, or you lose a job, or I'll tell you another, it's really easy to be remorseful in the back of a cop car. Oh, you know, I swear I'll never do it again, please. And you don't understand. And mean it, right? Well, on September 11th, 1990, I woke up that morning, I cracked my eyelids open after a binge and said, damn, I'm not dead. And then the thought, and then it's on you, and it's all gone. The money's gone, the booze is gone, the drugs are gone, the job's gone, it's all gone one more time. And then I look at my little boy and I started to cry and I said, that's it, I'm done. And that day, there was something in my head, and I don't know if it was an audible voice or if it was a thought, but it was crystal clear. It was this. When I said, that's it, I'm done with this. And the thought was, no, you're not. And the first time in my life, I knew I couldn't buy my lies. See, I had been lying to me. I had been trying to fix my alcoholism the way a non-alcoholic would fix it, right? What's a non-alcoholic do? There are non-alcoholics in our rooms. There are some in this room. They have been sentenced here by treatment centers or their jobs, and it's great. We have world-class fellowship. Nobody wants to leave once they get in here and find out. And, you know, it's a great place. Really, now, you don't want to come here if you're a real alcoholic, but if you're just a lonely drinker, it's a great place, right? You're one of those guys that put on Patsy Cline and drink and cry, you know. Jerry, there he is. This is a great... No. So, but if you're a real alcoholic, you don't want to come here. But this is world-class friends. So what I was trying to do was fix my alcoholism the way a non-alcoholic would fix it. I'm going to get it. Listen, what's a non-alcoholic do? That's it. I'm not going to drink or drive. I'm going to go get a job. I'm going to turn my life around. I'm going to pay my bills. I'm going to be a good dad. I'm going to be a good boyfriend. I'm going to be a good husband. If I could have done it, I would have done it. I was trying to fix something that was unfixable. And I didn't know it. Because what I'm trying to fix is what happens to me once I take a drink. I'm not going to go that far again. Really, what I wanted to fix was the consequences. I didn't want to fix the drinking, and I didn't know. See, I don't even know what the problem is. I've been drinking for 20 years. I have no clue what the problem is, so I can't fix it. And on September 11th, 1990, I woke up and I did that, and all of a sudden I knew I couldn't buy my BS one more time, and I said, that's it. I can't do this. I'm going to end now. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm going to try and follow the rules. What's it say in our book? It says, an alcoholic properly armed with the facts about himself can win the confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. So we got some time. They'll be going, oh, Jerry, why did you ask this guy? So that day, I knew I couldn't. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I was going to drink again. And I was done. And it was crystal clear in my mind. I had a moment of clarity. I knew what the problem was, and I knew I was not going to quit, and I made a decision. Just like the third step decision is monumental in our life, and it's followed by action, I made a decision that day. And here's what my decision was. I thought it was brilliant. I'm going to quit quitting. Because the quitting's killing me. Waking up in the morning and going, I can't do this anymore, and crying and looking at my son and feeling guilty. I'm done. I'm a drunk, and I'm going to die a drunk. And I knew it that day. I am going to die either in the gutter or in jail, and I don't know which one's coming first, but I knew it that day. And I had surrendered not to get sober. I don't know what your story is. But September 11th, the day before I got here, I surrendered to die of this disease. There was no more courage to do battle, Bill says. The courage to do battle was not there. I give up. I am done. I'm done getting up and pretending to be a non-alcoholic. See, that's what we do. We get up, we shower, we clean up, and we go pretend to be a non-alcoholic. I'm not going to drink. And I can't do that. And I didn't understand until I got here and I read it in Bill's story. Bill's very similar. His experience was very similar. On bottom of page 7 and top of page 8, he describes what happened to him. He says, so I was to go on joining the endless procession of sots that had gone on before me. He says, this was the end, the curtain. Alcohol, I had met my match. Alcohol was my master. He knew he was going to, he said, my wife was told that we would have to give me over to the undertaker, to the asylum. He says, I knew it and welcomed it. Death doesn't scare us. At that point, I wanted death. I did not want to wake up. I did not want to be that miserable failure of a human being that I had become and was absolutely incapable of changing it through willpower or knowledge or anything else, or desire, no human power, the greatest love in the world, threaten. I mean, do the test. Anybody here ever had legal problems because of drinking? How about relationship problems? Anybody here any had relationship? How about financial problems? How about health? Anybody ever jeopardize your health? I mean, go down the list. Make your own list that tells you to do that. You know, no human power. The love of my child could not have stopped me. So I knew I was doomed. And I didn't know it, but it says that over and over. In the doctor's opinion, in an AA, we have a lot. We say a lot of things in AA that aren't really true. Like, we're really smart, bright people. How'd we get here? I was 40 years old. I hadn't even been to an AA. meeting. I was so clueless, I didn't know I was clueless. The number one symptom of insanity is you don't know you have it. I'll bet you think you sound smart to you. Right? I think I sound smart to me. Thank God I know better. Thank God I know better. I'm the wrongest guy in the room, and I'm okay with that today. There's a freedom in it today. I don't have any ground to defend anymore. I would defend things that were undefendable. I'd talk to somebody outside for 2 minutes. They'd say something, and I'd turn around and tell somebody else, and they'd say, where did you hear that? And I'm going to defend this to the death. I don't know where we heard it, but I'm going to defend, because it's my ego is so invested in everything that I think and say. And so what happened that day is I made a decision that I was going to drink until I died, and I was done quitting. And now, how does that become my last day drinking? How does September 12th become my sobriety date? I've wondered that myself. Those of us that have been around a while know. There isn't a word for it. It's that power that we came here to find, because it wasn't my power. I had given up all my power. Matter of fact, I came here and I found that power, not by looking for the power, by finally understanding I have no power. When I created the void and was honest enough to create the void and stopped being the manager of my life, the power came in. You can't push the darkness out. You just let the light in. And the darkness goes away all by itself. And what happened was, is that night, September 11th, 1990, there was a knock on the door of that motel room. Now, at this point in your drinking, you do not open the door, okay? There's no good news out there. Publisher's Clearinghouse is not out there with the balloons and the big check and going, "We have had a hell of a time trying to find you." I go, "That's on purpose." Right? Nobody's finding me. My motto was, if I know you, I owe you. There's no, as Bill said, quicksand stretched around it and in all directions. There was no friendly direction in my life on that day. I was so angry, I wished I was two people so I could kick my own ass. That's how angry I was. And some people know what that's like. That self-loathing. The problem with self-loathing is, though, by the time you hate yourself that much, everybody else hates you too. So you're really in a fix. And there's tape on the peephole. I don't even want light to escape. But that night, I got up and I went over and I opened the door. Didn't even look. And after a couple, even my first 2 years of sobriety, I thought back on that night many times. And I thought, why did I open that door? I know why I did today. Because of that decision I made, I had nothing left to lose. I didn't have to pretend anymore. There was no more pretending to be non-alcoholic. There was no more pretending that I wasn't as bad as I was. And I opened the door and my brother walked in, who I hadn't seen in a long time. And he didn't lecture me. And I believe today he said the only thing that any human being could have said to me that would have changed the course of my life. He didn't lecture me. He didn't look at me with disdain. But I did see the horror in his eyes when he looked at my little boy. And he didn't say, "Tell me, you know, you're a drunk, or you got to get some, you know, you got to go get help." It was nothing like that. He walked in, he looked at the filth, I could see the horror in his eyes, and he just didn't say anything to me, and he looked at my little boy. And here's what he said: "If you want, I will watch your son if you want to get help." And I knew the ship was going down, and I wanted to hand my son off. Take him, because I'm going down. And I can't stop it anymore. I can't pretend to be a dad. I can't pretend that there's anything left inside of me, any small amount of good inside of me at all. And that was the only thing that stopped my... And then on September 12th, 1990, when I came to that morning, I made the call. He left his phone number there, and he turned around and walked out. And I made that call. And that changed the course of my life. And what happened was, is I called him and he took us in and took us into his apartment. Now, I didn't know about AA. I'd never been to an AA, so I didn't run to AA. I wouldn't have known where to find you if I'd known about you. I heard the word AA once or twice, but I don't remember anything, you know, where I even frame of reference. But I've heard of treatment. I said, okay, treatment. I can get treatment. I'll do some treatment. I didn't know what it was, but I figure, okay, they're going to treat me. They'll give me something. Give me a pill. They'll teach me something. They'll give me a suppository, something that's going to make me feel, they'll fix me. Right? Again, the fix is going to come from the outside. And I discovered something. Newcomers know this really well, too. Especially chronic relapsers know this little trick. The moment you say you want to get well, everybody, oh, isn't that great? Everybody loved me then. And they were all supportive of me. Nobody hated me anymore because I was going to go to treatment. Well, I'm looking for the Betty Ford Center. I need the Olympic pool, the weight room. And I'd heard it was 28 days. I can do 28 days, okay? I'll do 28 days. I'll get a little sun. I'll be fine, you know, work out a little bit, and I'll be back on my feet. They don't take people like me. So eventually we found a treatment center, and it was a place that took that would only for indigents. Indigents are people that can't support themselves, homeless people. So they took me in there, and when I got there, and while I was waiting for a bed, I had to wait 4 or 5 days. And while I was waiting for a bed, I remember my brother must have found somebody in AA, and this woman called the house and said, "Hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting?" I said, "Oh, no, thank you. I'm going to get treatment." And, but I'm proud of you. You stick with it, okay? I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue. I was a dropout from society. I'm telling you, I was one of these guys that raced towards my next buzz. And heck, I didn't pay income tax for 20 years. I mean, it's just one of those things, you know. What happened was that they took me in this treatment center, and they told me it was 6 months. 6 months? I can't stay in here 6 months. They gave me this stupid test. They asked me some questions. You've ever lied about your alcohol or drugs? Has it ever caused you to steal? Has it ever affected your work? Is it, you know, oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm going, this is looking gloomy. I need one no answer. Maybe I'll get some time off the 6 months for good behavior. And they finally asked me a question. They said, has alcohol or drugs ever affected your menstrual cycle? No, it has not. And I got no time off for that. Right? So what happened was is they put me in this now. This was September 17th, 1990, my first night, and there was a Friday night, and that's my 40th birthday. That's how I celebrated my 40th birthday. It was the worst day of my life, I thought. I was wrong about that, like I've been wrong about everything in my life. And I remember standing outside, and I was trying to be the cool guy in the treatment center for indigents. You know, by the way, cool alcoholic is an oxymoron. It doesn't exist. We know we're all trying to be cool, but it really doesn't exist, okay? That's the great freedom that we get in here. We don't have to be cool. You know, I have a buddy of mine, he says to his sponsees, he goes, if you're an alcoholic, we know what you did. Because we all did it. At 4 o'clock in the morning when nobody was looking, when you were so lonely and crippled with self-loathing that you would have done anything for acceptance. We know what you did. We know how desperate your spirit was. And what happened was, is that Friday night I'm standing outside smoking. We didn't vape back then. We were real men. We smoked. So. And we didn't wear our hats backwards or the flat brim caps. We creased those bad boys. I'm trying to be the cool guy in the treatment center for homeless people, and I'm the oldest guy there, all right? I'm 40 years old. And this kid pulls up, and he gets out of his car. He's got a nice car. It's a Friday night, and he gets out of his car, and he's got clean clothes on. He's got creased pants. He's got a nice pressed collared shirt on. And I, wow, and this kid's going to, we got a class coming, right? I don't know what the class is. But we got a class coming, and this guy's, and I'm thinking to myself, he's 28 years old. I'm going, I wonder what they're paying this kid. I could do this gig. And he comes in, and he sits down. Now, I didn't recognize it, but it was an AA meeting, right? I don't know what an AA meeting is, but he starts telling a little bit about his story. And he said a few things I didn't agree with there. He said, the first thing he said was, you never have to take another drink or drug again if you don't want to. And I knew that was crap. I knew it was crap because I had not wanted to for a long time. And I would just do it over and over again. It talks about it on page 24. It says, there comes a point in the drinking of every alcoholic when the strongest desire to stop using is of absolutely no avail. What that means is wanting to stop drinking has no effect on stopping drinking. Useless. Oh, I want to stop. I want to quit. I'm never going to do this again. Useless. Doesn't work. Only action. Only an action works. And so I knew it didn't agree with that. But he said something that caught my attention. He says, you never have to feel the way you feel tonight again. This was my 40th birthday. I'm in a treatment center for indigents. I'm an utter failure at every area of my life, every relationship I've ever been. The only people left in my life are people willing to forgive me. There was nobody I didn't alienate or take advantage of. I'm an absolute failure as a father to one of the most beautiful kids you'd ever seen in your life. So I would have given any... There were 50 people in that treatment center, and I would have traded lives with any one of them that night, and I didn't know anybody. But I'll take your life, you can have mine that night. That's how low I felt. And then he said a couple other things. He said, there's 50 of you in here. At the end of 6 months, there won't be 5 of you left. I went, whoa. He was right. There were 2 of us left. Now, I don't know why I was one, but I was one. I know why today. See, what I thought was I was coming to... Here's what I thought. And a lot of us think this. We come in here because we're drowning. Please, save me. And we think AA is going to save you. We don't save you. We teach you to be a lifeguard. That's what we do in here. It's not about you. You don't go through the steps and you're done. That's like going in the military and going through boot camp. And they say, okay, you can go home now. You're done. No, you are now fit for service. The steps spiritually fit you for service. You've already squandered your life. Right? If you're an alcoholic of my type, you gave it your best shot. There was never one day I woke up in the morning and said, today I'm going to burn my life to the ground. Not one day. As bad as it got, I would wake up in the morning and say, today I'm going to be as happy and as successful as I could be, even if it meant getting a six-pack. So, that was my best effort. Took me to that motel room on September 11th. My best thinking, my best effort took me there. And I don't recoup it. Now, I did think this for a while. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I wanted to do was come back and learn how to shoplift recovery and become a successful version of me. But that isn't exactly how it worked out for me. So what happened is I stayed in that treatment center for 6 months, and I got out of that treatment center, and I went where every good alcoholic goes, 40-year-old alcoholic. Mom, I'm home. And I got 6 months sober, you know. And now my folks lived in a little place. It was where's Mike? He knows the place. He knows the area. It's the retirement capital of the world. This was 1990. It's the elephant burial ground. You got to be 1,000 years old. They check your birth certificate when you cross the county line. There's only like retirement communities, and my folks had a little place in a retirement community. It was a manufactured home, and you know what that is. It was kind of halfway between a trailer and a house. I called it Mom's Halfway House. And so I'm staying with Mom in Mom's Halfway House, and I'm sitting there my first night out, and I remember smoking a cigarette on the front stoop, and there's this old guy next door. And I'm like, man, what has my life become? Now, they had set my girlfriend and my son up in an apartment because she was still actively using, so I couldn't go back to her, but I wanted to. They bought this place so they could be close and we could have my son as often as possible. And so this old man kind of saddles up. I see him watering his lawn, and I can see him kind of saddling up. You know how you old-timers do when you see a newcomer, right? And you start drooling. Ooh, yeah. Was I drooling? I'm sorry. You're going to save me. We don't care if you drink, but I need you. Hey, I killed a few in the beginning. Everybody does. Giving them advice, right? Go punch that girl in the nose. And so this old guy comes up and he says, hey, my name's Frank, and I hear you had some trouble with alcohol or drugs at home. Mom's been talking, huh? He said, would you like to go to an AA meeting tonight? Sure. It's either that or stay home and watch Lawrence Welk or some crap with Mom, right? Whatever. So he says, I'll pick you up at 7:15. So 7:15, I look outside. Now I'm going to describe something to you. Tell me if you recognize this. 7:15, he didn't beep the horn. He didn't come to the door. He sat out there in his little car, and just the car was idling. And that old guy was sitting out there and never honked his horn. And eventually I got out and I got into his car and we drove away. Went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is 50 people in this room. Everybody is so old, you cannot put together a full set of teeth. And they're going, if you want what we have, they talk like you. And I'm sitting there going, these people are so lucky I'm desperate or I wouldn't be here. Now, I didn't know that's how it works, that you only come here. Nobody volunteers for AA. And by the way, this is it. If you're new, this is the bottom of the barrel. We do not refer you out. There's nowhere past AA. Whoops, you overshot AA. You might catch this one. This is it. Grab on. You're going down. So I'm in this meeting, and so finally he takes me back home, and the next day I'm having dinner with my mom, and I look over my mom's shoulder. There's this little old man. Now, let me tell you how old he was. He's 3 years younger than I am today. At that point. Man, doesn't that suck? But I don't feel old. I've had all the mirrors taken out of my house. Somebody slipped one in one day. I screamed. I go, honey, call the cops. There's a fat old bald man in our bathroom. Naked. Oh, it was me. So I look over his shoulder, and there is that car sitting out there idling. And he never beeped the horn. And now I got a little angry because I go, I missed the part about us going steady. But, and I bet I can outwait this guy. But I could not outwait him. And eventually I got out and I went and got into his car and we drove off and went to a meeting. And you know what that's called? Unconditional love. And I wouldn't have known it if it hit me in the name of the Father. And he put me on the circuit. Frank taught me. He's still my sponsor today. Talked to him this morning. And I love that man. He set me free in so many ways. Frank was a real sponsor. I would come to him with whatever I had, and he would send me to God. His favorite line was, I want you to pray about it, and let me know how God works it out. Frank, I need more concrete direction. I'm dying here. I got felonies. I haven't paid the IRS in 20 years. I got no child support. I'm living with Mom in the halfway house. I need some direction. And that was his favorite line. But we'd go to meetings, and he would set me free in so many ways. And I would watch Frank, and he was always talking to newcomers. I couldn't figure out how he spotted them, right? We know who you are. And I just formally asked you to raise your hands before. We already knew who you were. So he would tell me things like this. I remember one day we're going to a meeting and we would always be picking up new guys in his car. Frank always had a car full of new guys. He wasn't a big book thumper. He was a big book liver. He lived that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were on a circuit. We went to a meeting every single night. And there weren't meetings like there are today. We were in the boonies. I mean, we had to drive an hour each way. I go, Frank, you're a fanatic. Don't you ever take a friggin' day off? I mean, what about Monday night football? And he would say stupid things like, well, did you drink fanatically? Well, if you put it that way. And then I would say, Frank, when is this thing going to work on me? Because I didn't like you. I didn't want to be in AA. I was here because I was desperate. I was looking for graduation day. I was looking for the cruise control button. When am I going to feel better? And I wait to get back to South Beach. I was from Miami. I used to own a bar on South Beach. I need to get back where I can be Miami Joe. That was my nickname. Unfortunately, nobody called me that but me. I'm one of the. I need a nickname. So, and he would say things like this to me that set me free. I go, when am I going to feel like? When is AA going to work on me? When is, I'm not like you, Frank. I don't care about these people. When am I going to feel like a nice guy? When am I going to feel like helping other people? He said, if you wait till you feel like a nice guy before you start living like one, you'll be dead. Wow. You mean it's okay to be a phony? He goes, let's not change now. Easy does it. And little things like that. We started in on step. He introduced me to prayer. He said, I want you to pray. Oh, I got a problem with God. He goes, I'm not talking. Don't pray to God. Just pray. Just pray to something other than you. I was okay with that. Because I'm going to tell you what. I said this for many years, and I discovered it recently. I've said, and I've heard it at meetings. I think I probably heard it somewhere. I was out of ideas. We've heard people say that at meetings, right? That's not the truth. I've just been repeating. I realized I wasn't out of ideas. The great truth was this. I was absolutely 100% convinced that all my ideas were bad. I knew my next idea would get me closer to a drink. And I was afraid to make... That's why I stayed in that Lady Lake, Florida, in that trailer park with the retirees. That's why I stayed there, because I knew... If you ROR'd me, for those of us that have been in the court system, we know what that means. Release on my own recognizance. You know, you hope the judge says that. We're going to ROR the guy, right? I knew if you released me to go back to Miami, I wouldn't last. It would only be a matter of time before I drank, before I screwed up, because I've always screwed up. How about you? I've always screwed up. See, that's step one. Frank taught me step one. He said to me in a language you can understand, I'm going to tell you step one and step two. Here's step one. Very simple, basic. You're screwed. That's it. It's not good news. And he said, if you're not 100% convinced you will drink again, you will drink again. See, I knew. That's why I stayed there. I didn't have to want to do this. I just had to do it. It's like mopping the floor. Who the hell wants to mop the floor? Mop the floor. Just mop the floor. Manual labor. That's all this is in the beginning, manual labor. And then I said, well, Frank, that's terrible news. I mean, if that's the case, then it sounds like it's going to take a friggin' miracle. He said, that's step two. And it is. Listen, this is nothing less than miraculous, okay? We can disguise it. We can talk about like it's calisthenics. Go do the steps again. Go rework a step four. That's all great stuff. And I'm not saying it's bad, but the truth is it's a miracle. When you get to the promises in step 10 and it tells you this thing has been given us with no effort on our part. What we did is we came over here. We're like... Forgive me for saying this. We're like the little old lady that comes to the meeting and knits. She's probably in here. No offense. But the next thing you know, she's got 25, 30 years sober. We come in here and they make us do commitments. Commitments. I want you to be at my house at 2 o'clock in the morning. I want you to make coffee in this meeting. I want you to go set up chairs over there. I want you to call me every day. And we start doing these commitments, and they save your life. They save your life. That's all. I'm going to go set up the chairs. There are many times I said, I'm going to go set up the chairs Saturday night, and then as soon as I'm done with that, I'm leaving and going to get drunk. Right? And something that commitment saved my life. He would say things like this, your head's still crazy, but as long as your feet aren't crazy. And we did the third step on our knees. Frank, I remember when he introduced me to prayer, and I had to. Are we getting close on time? How are we doing on time? Fine? Oh, good. Oh. I'm going to tell you something else. You want to listen? No. He would. I remember I had to find a job, right? And I was there like 4 days, and I went down. And at this time, I know you're going to be surprised, but I was a car salesman. Okay. I'm a recovered car salesman. Through the grace of God and the fellowship of AA, I've not found it necessary to sell a car today. But at that time, so I went down to the local car lot and got a job. And the manager there was a guy that I used to drink with and party with years earlier down in South Florida. He had come up and working in this dealership, right? And he was a single guy, and I was single at that time. Now, I was still about 5-6 months, probably 7 months sober. I was out of treatment, but I was only a month or two out of treatment. And he's got a jet ski, and he's got a little sports car, the company car. He's going to the beach on the weekends. I want to go with this guy, man. So we start hanging out, you know, and I remember we're going to the beach one day to ride the Wave Runners. And then one night he says, listen, let's go to Orlando. There's these great clubs I want to go to. I don't think this is information my sponsor needs. So, right? I'm only going to listen to the music. Right? And we end up in Orlando, and which is about 50 miles away. Now, I'm in Orlando, and he's drunk and high, and he's, you know, he's got women in scantily dressed clothes dancing in front of him. And I'm going, the panic gripped me. It was like Bill in that hotel lobby. This was one of my Bill W. moments. And if you're new, you're going to have a lot of Bill W. moments. And they aren't moments that you just say, oh, well, I know what the right thing to do is. No, it doesn't come easy. It's like pulling teeth. I was in there and I was sweating and I was panicked. And you can only drink so many club sodas. And I said, you got to take me home. And I don't know why. Instead of joining in, because I knew I was at that moment where I'm either going to join in or I'm going to leave. And I said, you have to take me home. And I got panicked. Fear gripped me, as Bill says in his story. And I knew. And the moment I said, you have to take me home. And what did Bill say right after he said fear gripped? He said, sanity returned. See, I've never been... See, you know what sanity is for me? I don't know what it is for you. Sanity for me is being able to connect the drink to the consequences. They were never connected. I'm going to drink and I'm not going to get this. They're connected. It's a package deal and I didn't know it. We get into a big fight. Now, this guy's my boss. Now, I own a company today and I have a lot of people. And one of my sayings is this. If you have a problem with the boss, you're the problem. So I'm screaming at my boss in this club, you got to take me home. We're 50 miles away. He's not leaving. He's not going anywhere. I ended up taking a taxi. 50 miles. I go home. And the next day I have to go back to work. Now, he's embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. You know, because he showed his behind. So he pages me, calls me down to the office. He says, Joe Krogan, come to the office. I hear it. So I go down. He goes, have a seat. He goes, I know you go to those AA meetings. I said, yeah, Tony, you know I do. He goes, tell me the truth. Do you talk about me there? Now, wait, I didn't then, I do now. So, I know I'm screwed, right? I've run back to my office after he gets through. You know, I go, Frank, I am not long for this job. My boss thinks I'm talking about him in AA. You know you're done. And I said, this is terrible. He goes, great. Because he said, this is what I want you to do. Yes. I want you to go home and pray about it. And call me tomorrow and let me know how God works it out. Now, this is true. The next day I show up for work. No Tony. He's not around. I see his little sports car get towed in on a tow truck, and it's got 6 bullet holes in it. He got shot the night before trying to buy crack cocaine. Listen, don't worry. It was a small caliber gun. It's a merciful God. He wasn't hurt bad. Okay? But I never saw Tony again. I ran back to my office and said, Frank, you won't believe it. God shot the guy 6 times. What? It's true. Now, I'd like to tell you that everything went wonderful. I got custody of my son at 1 year sober, and my son came to live with me, and that was a scary proposition, but he came to live with me when I needed to find out how to love somebody. And I'll tell you, he saved my life many nights knowing he was asleep in that other room. Commitment. You see, I'm a guy that discipline always looked like punishment. How about you? Right? Gun to the head guy. You're not making me do it. I'm raising my son, and Frank's working at Intergroup, answering phones, and all of a sudden he comes home, and we've gone through the steps, and I breezed through the steps as best I, quickly as I could. You know, I want to get the heat off my back. And he comes in, and he tells me one day, he says, man, there's this beautiful girl that answers the phones at Intergroup. I fell in love with this girl before I met her. I became an AA stalker, okay? Don't worry, you guys will too. It's you're going to have to fall off the horse a few times. And so I call Intergroup, and I knew Frank wasn't there. I knew one time Frank went to the bathroom. But I says, Frank there, right? No, he's not there. Great. I zoom over there, and I walk in like, hey, where's Frank? You know, so I could meet her. I did that when it came to my fourth step too, right? He was trying to get me to do a fourth step, and he lived right next door. And I was avoiding him like the plague. I would turn my car off and my lights off by this time I had a car and coast in the driveway. I had all the blinds drawn on that side of the house, looked like a crack house. I would look over, and when his car was gone, I'd call the house. I'd go, hey, Frank, where the heck are you? I want to do this fourth step thing. We know how to work the system, okay? And the ones, the newcomers that aren't smiling are the ones that are doing that right now with their sponsor. And because that's the first thing you get back is your opinions. And so anyway, I meet this girl. We fall madly in love. Boy meets girl on AA campus. You could hear the suction across the county. I'm cruising to meetings. I'm at this meeting looking in the window. If she's not there, 8:03, I got to run all the way across town to the other meeting and hopefully she's, and then walk in like I'm just nonchalant. She had 2 kids. She was divorced. I had my son. We hooked up together. By this time, I'm sober. You know, when you stop committing felonies, life gets better. And you stop drinking on a daily basis, right? So, and you show up for work. So I started getting promoted, and things started happening in my life. And, of course, the ego regenerates itself in no time. Now, I think I deserve to be in better position. These are the promises coming true. Next thing I know, we get a job offer in West Palm Beach, Florida. Big job offer as a general manager of a car dealership. It's the best job I'd ever have. I'm not qualified, but I interview well. Right? I think I'll learn as I go. I go into this job and drag my family down there, and we move into a home. And I'll tell you, I stop going to meetings. I'm working 14 hours a day. I don't have time. I'm too busy for AA. The cart is before the horse. And what happened was, is after about a year, the fights were terrible. I've got a cardboard cutout of a husband that I put up when I go home. I got a cardboard cutout of a dad that I put up when I go home. But I'm not there, and I'm not present. And I'm not going to meetings. And after about a year, she goes, that's it. If I'm going to be alone, I want to be alone. I want a divorce. I'm devastated. And threw me out. My little boy and I are walking out the door, and the last thing she said to me was, can't you see that all your relationships end the same? Now, I didn't hear it then, but I heard it when I went through the steps again. And I did some inventory work and did a fourth step where I saw the patterns in my life. That all my relationships ended. Defective relationship were the cause of all of my woes, including my alcoholism. And I saw this. I saw that my selfish and self-centeredness, that I... See, life was a piece of pie. When you're selfish and self-centered, life is a pie. There's only so many pieces. As long as I'm getting a piece, I'm happy. But even if you don't know... When someone else gets a piece, they're secretly, I'm jealous. And that's a piece I'm not going to get. And what happens in AA when you do these steps, you find out God's grace is inexhaustible. There's plenty for everybody. There is absolutely plenty for you to be exactly who God created you to be. Now, I don't know what that is. And most of us don't know what it is when we get here. But it's awesome when you find out. What happened was, is after a few, two or three months, I'm so angry and so mad. And I am going to wrap this up. So what happens is that they fire me from my job because I'm so angry, so mad. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I'm just a resentment walking around. And now I'm on my way home one night and I see, and I'm not going to, I don't have any recovery, any meetings. When Frank calls, I'm telling him I'm not there. And I go by this bar that I saw and caught my attention. I said, if I go back out, I'm going to drink in that bar. It had a name I was real attracted to. It said Bar. You know it, right? I said, I could be a big shot in that place for a while. And I drove by that bar every night for 6 nights. I circled that place like a buzzard circling a carcass. But I'm going to tell you, you can't. It's hard to pick up a drink at 5.5 years sober when you know. See, I had unworked all the steps except step one. I knew that when I drink, my lifestyle is about to change. And on day 7, I'm so angry, I hadn't slept, I'm so mad, I curse God, and I leave my boy asleep in the back room. And I drove across town, I said, tonight I don't care, I'm drinking. If I cannot take this anymore, I can't take the pain. And I drive to that bar, I'm one block away from that bar, and I'm stopped at a red light, and there's a street light over here, and I could see the bar. I got butterflies in my stomach, I can feel them. I know what I'm about to do. I know this decision is life-changing. And like I always say, I know I'm not under any illusion that I will be drinking out of stemmed glassware at the piano bar. I might have glass stemware, but it won't be at the piano bar. And what happens is I look over and underneath this streetlight, there's a broken-down van with its hood up. And the front license plate said, "Have you prayed today?" And I did something really stupid. I said the Serenity Prayer. Because I was in so much pain. And I drove across town, and I call it a sober blackout. I don't know how it happened. I drove across town to a meeting I'd been to one time on a year earlier, and I walked in the back of the room, and there were about this many people in the room. And there was a man at the podium, and he said, "This is anniversary night. We're celebrating anniversaries. It's the month of September. Is there anyone else here celebrating an anniversary?" I go, "It's my 6-year anniversary." I raised my hand like a knucklehead. And I'm sitting in the back of the room. And he goes, "Well, okay, we have about 6 or 7 celebrants. What we do here is everybody takes turns and shares about 5 minutes how they stayed sober." Yeah, it's funny to you guys, right? Wasn't funny that night. Now, and he said, "Since we have a visitor, why don't you start us off?" And I walked up from the back of the room and I got to the podium. And I turned around and I looked out. And I saw the kindness of strangers. And I started to cry. And I started to sob. I couldn't talk. I said, "I need help. I don't know how to do this thing. I'm lost." And I just stood there crying. And finally, 2 guys rushed me off the stage because the treatment center had brought the van and they were all in the front row. The guy gets up and I hear him as they're taking me out. They go, "That's not how it is at 6 years sober. He's just humble." And Alcoholics Anonymous, the kindness of strangers. Those 2 men sat with me in that kitchen till 11:30 that night. They were afraid to leave me alone. They took me home. They dropped me off. They took the keys to my car. And they said, "We'll be back at 7:30 in the morning." They came back at 7:30 in the morning and they had a foursome for golf. An AA foursome. They made me ride around in a golf cart with them for 4 hours. Then they took me to a noon meeting. And those men introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous again. The real program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They took me through the steps again. They started getting me sponsoring guys. They took me into treatment centers and detoxes. I got commitments again. They said, "Let's go back to rock bottom. What have you got left?" I got my son and I got AA. And he said, "Well, you can probably be good at both of those if you want to be." And I said, "That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a good..." And I got off the treadmill. I was 46 years old and I was done. The illusion that I was going to be discovered was gone. You know, I always thought I was going to be discovered. I don't know for what. But I didn't care anymore. And I said, you know what? And I took some suggestions. My sponsor told me, he says, why don't you get a crummy job? Because I couldn't go back to the car business and work 14 hours. I had my son. So I said, take a crummy job. And I was willing to go to work at 7-Eleven. I said, I need a job where I can take my son to school in the morning and pick him up at night. And I did that every day. And I made dinner at home every night. We had dinner, stir fry every night. It was either chicken or beef. That's all I could. I wasn't a good, but he liked it, you know. We had to have a stick of furniture in our living room. We played tackle football in there every night. I coached him in Little League in baseball, basketball, and football. It was one of the happiest times of his life. It was one of the happiest times of my life. And I took that crummy job. I became willing to take that crummy job. And I'm going to tell you, something happened when I took that crummy job, not to get a better job or not because I was embarrassed of it. I fell in love with the job. I still do it today. As a matter of fact, I've started three companies doing it and sold three companies. And I'm not qualified. You've seen my resume. I'm not qualified. But that's what happens when you give up trying to run your own life. A year later, we were at a conference and I ran into my ex-wife. And we started to date because we were still in love. And she became my third wife. Some are sicker than others. She was seconds from a clean getaway, man. I put the hook out. But we knew, like the book says, for us, this marriage to be successful, we were going to have to be on a different basis, a basis of trusting God. And it talks about it in the book. It says that we invite our wife into our morning meditation. We pray together today. We pray for our marriage on days when we don't want to pray together. When it sounds like this. Do you want to pray? Now, we've been married 19 years, so go figure. We couldn't make it a year and a half the first time. What's different? Maybe God's involved. Maybe God's involved. And the commitment of that marriage is involved. Today I'm a good husband and I'm a good father. And God saw fit to give us another chance. We have two twin boys that were born out of that romance back then. They just turned 19 years old this past July. They're both in college. They're the greatest kids in the world. And I love these kids. They're polar opposites. One's a scholar student at the University of Miami. The other one, if you see him looking in a dictionary, he's looking up dirty words. He's like his dad, right? But I love these kids. And they know they're loved. We have the greatest family. We have an AA house. There's nights where she has tons of girls in there. She sponsors a lot of, I sponsor a lot of men. We have our marching orders today. We have, it says on the top of page 64, when these men have discovered the joy of helping others, there will be no stopping them. It's, you got to discover it. It's like shucking clams, man. You got to go through, or shucking oysters. You got to go through a lot to find the pearl. I killed a few. I told you. But you know what? I love AA, and there's nothing more magical. There's nothing. If you don't find a way to get high on your recovery, you're going to get high on something else. Remember that. See, because I didn't like controlled drinking. I do not like controlled recovery. So I'll tell you a quick story, and I'm going to end. There was a bar in Miami that we used to love, and we would go in there. It was an after-hours club. And you ring the bell, and they open the little door, and they would peek out. If they knew you, they'd let you in. It was the greatest bar in the world, man. I loved this place. It was 500 people, no windows. You'd go in there on your Saturday night. You'd have your disco clothes on. Disco was a place people danced. You go in there, and I mean, everything went on in this bar. People were shot, killed, but all the limos would be lined up. No signs, no nothing. I mean, you had to know this place. It was a real after hours club, and it was infamous. And here's why I loved it. At 10 o'clock in the morning, now Saturday night you're in there, now 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning, you got to leave. They would open the door, and you're on Miami Beach, and the sun would be out, and you'd be like, and you're still in your disco clothes, right? But they would give you a full glass of whatever it is you drank. We used to call them roadies back then. Miami was okay to drink and drive. At least we all did it everywhere. And they gave me a full glass of scotch. I drank scotch back then. And they would give you cardboard sunglasses. It was heaven. You're walking out on Sunday morning. I remember getting in my car one day, and I drove to the traffic light a block away. I'm sitting there with my cardboard sunglasses, cigarette hanging out, and a drink in my hand. And I look over, and next to me is a little car with a little family sitting in it. A man and wife in the front seat, and they're all dressed up. And in the back seat, the little boy and little girl are identically dressed to the mom and dad. And you know where they're going. It's Sunday morning. And I look over and go, whew, what a bunch of losers. And I'm sure the kid looked over and said, hey, Dad, look, the Antichrist. But today, because of a loving God that I discovered in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the 12 steps and sponsorship, I'm in that car. Thank you.